Well, good day, wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. Kirk and I are here. And, Kirk, I'm going to begin by testing your memory.
Okay.
Does the name Yisrael Crystal mean anything to you?
Crystal?
Yisrael Crystal.
No, I'm
I used him as an example. Remember we were sharing a passage where Yahweh said that he was going to recalibrate the length of a human life, prior to the flood, people could live up to 1,000 years. And we did a program on the elasticity of our genes and the particular triggering mechanism that loses its elasticity, causing human life to have really an outside threshold of 120 years, which is exactly what God said he was resetting it to. And he reset it because, given enough time, men and women find ways to do really awful things.
Yeah, worse and worse.
Right. So the person that I cited as the world's oldest man, still alive at the time, living in Yisrael, in Haifa, as a matter of fact, was Yisrael Crystal, was the man's name.
Now I recall, yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, Yisrael Crystal is no longer among the living. He died. I never surpassed the age of 113, which was the age that he was and when I provided this report. He's an interesting individual in that, A, the Iowa said no one is going to exceed the outward limit of a man's life would be 120 years. At 113 and the oldest living man, now 113, he's dead. But once again, Yahweh's information proved to be 100% accurate. It's one of the things about being really careful when you say anything relative to God's message to us.
Mm-hmm.
He is 100% accurate, right down to the details. And it's one of the ways you can tell that something has come from him. You know, he says, you know, if somebody says something and it does not come to pass, consistent with the way it has been portrayed, then it did not come from him. So when he said, "Man shall not, the life of a man shall not exceed 120 years," bank on the fact that it is that statement's from him. It will continue to be true, and it is. The other thing that's interesting is the timing of this man's life. He was born prior to World War I, and he lost both born in Poland, lost both of his parents in World War I. So that's a tough way to start out life, with both parents dying in World War I. In World War II, he was living in and still living in Poland, and he was he moved to Lodz to work in the family confectionery business. But after the invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany in 1939, he was forced into the Lodz ghetto. Do you know why Germany chose to invade Poland? I mean, Poland was no threat to Germany. Why did Germany choose to invade Poland?
Well, I can speculate. I'm not really sure. Obviously, it's a gateway to Russia and a buffer for Russia, which they were afraid of, the Soviet Union. They had a huge Jewish population, a Yehudim.
Not the reason. The reason is that the Germany did not have access to sufficient amounts of oil to engage in war.
Mm-hmm.
They could not effectively propel their aircraft and their tanks with the oil available to them in Germany. And Standard Oil had come up with a gasification process of coal.
Oh, that one.
And the and that.
That in Poland?
George Prescott Bush and George Walker.
The other Bush.
Which became the name for King George I and King George II, working with Union Bank and the Nazi Party and Hitler. Gained control of coal mines in Poland, and we're having a very difficult time controlling the labor force there. And so slave labor was the best option. Absolute German control over those coal mines and slave labor resolved the problem of the fuel for the German war machine. So George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, working with the Nazis and Hitler, planned the invasion of Poland. Auschwitz was the direct result. This man, he was transferred to Auschwitz. Both of his children, he had two children, both of them died in the Lodz ghetto prior to being transferred to Auschwitz. And once in Auschwitz, his wife was murdered by the Germans. And he survived as a slave laborer, working for the Nazis until he was liberated in 1945 by the Russians, at which time he only weighed about 75 pounds. Shortly thereafter, he immigrated to Israel. 1950 is when he immigrated to Israel. So the man's life really tells us a great deal about him, doesn't it?
Well, it led us right into the end times, didn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. And the rise of anti-Semitism and the denial of Israelites of their rights. Mm-hmm. God made a number of promises to them. And just as he said, man shall not exceed 120 years in terms of his life expectancy, he made a lot of promises to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
To the descendants of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. Jacob, who we renamed Israel, which would be then the 12 tribes. 13, if you count the Lowi. All were assigned specific areas. And he gave Israel to them and made a number of promises to Israel, that he said were eternal promises.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't reassigned those promises to anyone. As a matter of fact, almost all of the end times predictions talk about a reconciliation between Israel and Yehudah. Yehudah representing two of the 12 tribes, being one specific tribe, but covering an area that represents two tribes of the 12 to 13. And they are being reconciled not only with Yahweh, but with the Torah itself upon his return. So Yirmiyah 31 makes it absolutely clear that the promises he made to Israel have not been transferred to anyone, and most especially not a Gentile church.
No. You know, it was interesting, this story, that what I tried to do, the two directions, there's a lot of stuff archaeologists have discovered to trace people where they went and what they did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I started out with going through a lot of specific some of them prophetic, but a lot of these promises and so forth and things that pertain to these 12 tribes throughout the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
I found some amazing things. I'm not a great translator, but I look up the words and research the words and research the words and try to pick up everything I can on what that word can possibly mean, so that in whatever context we're reading, we can mm-hmm. figure out what he's really trying to convey. And
right.
I can give you some short forms on this, and I think today we should go through whatever time we can have available. We should go through what those promises are per.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, as you trace to the people, too, that the majority of those people that were scattered
yes.
were, in fact, scattered north mm-hmm. of Israel.
Yes.
In fact, even in Morocco and Tunisia, where a number of them fled after there were a lot of them in Spain and throughout Europe because of the Romans enslaving them not once but twice and dragging them off into Europe as slaves. And then when the Muslims came in, they went down into Morocco and Tunisia. Even Morocco and Tunisia are north of most of Israel. Mm-hmm. But of course, so is all of Turkey and Syria, for example, and Lebanon, and then throughout Russia, where there have been many, and France and the like. So it's mm-hmm. it is interesting that he says he's going to draw them from the north, and if you even look at the parallel of Israel, most of the United States is north of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the place where most Jews concentrate in the United States, the Northeast, is absolutely north of Israel.
Right. Well, the tricky part of this is you have to have enough information on what Yahweh actually said mm-hmm. in order to defend any position on where they went. But it's pretty obvious when you divide off the two. I'm going to just talk all mm-hmm. the stuff right here for a minute rather than, and then
sure.
we'll get into some real details and proving different things. But you can trace the northern tribes of Israel, even though they had a substantial amount of Yehudim with them,
right.
Lowi as well. They obviously move. You can trace those people going all the way up through the Caucasus and also through Greece and over through Eastern Europe all the way to Northern Europe.
Is the first time that Jews were hauled forcibly away from collectively Israel. If Israel represents Ephraim, the northern kingdom, and the southern kingdom of Yehuda, this was by the Assyrians, not the Babylonians.
Right.
And they were hauled into to captivity. But most of them were not hauled into Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. But instead...
No, they were most definitely not. They didn't want them there. They wanted them as a
right.
buffer from Persia.
Right. And so that's why they were in these areas of eastern Turkey and throughout the regions of the Caucasus Mountains and the Caspian Sea and the like, is that that's where they served as the most effective barrier and buffer for the Assyrians.
In archaeology, archaeologists, just like when we were talking about Egypt, we discovered in the 1800s that all of a sudden archaeology is born and people are starting to, it's a form of grave digging, but they go through these different things and they find the same symbols, the same products, the same information and charts and so forth through all these burial grounds that lead all the way through up to Northern Europe, and the thing that was most interesting that started this for me was heraldry is a kind of a science and an art form, but mostly a science of what people carried and symbols they carried. And Yahweh talks a lot about what their symbols were for each tribe. He gave them all symbols. They all have a primary, and some of them even have secondary and tertiary symbols mm-hmm. that they used, and they carried them from the very start when they laid out the tribes out in yeah. the wilderness.
A God-given family crest.
Yes, indeed. And when you read the promises and you look at their symbols, you go, my gosh. And the interesting part about it, other than the fact that it's exactly the same, is you only find them with certain groups of people. And
yeah.
you can trace those people, and you go wherever they are. They happen to have those similar things. They have. You can trace them all back to the Middle East. And it's just the most remarkable
yeah.
amount of information.
Yeah. None more so stunning than the Iberian Peninsula and the realization that the original name for Spain all the way through the Roman period was a transliteration of Eber, the Hebrew word for Hebrew. Yeah, the Hebrew word for Hebrew. The country was literally bore their name, and it bore their symbol in terms of the lion.
You know, in the background, I was talking with Dr. Jeff and a few other members of the covenant with friends and all, and we were talking about some of these things, and it's kind of staggering that if you look at all the promises and what he says they're going to do, you find them all in Western Europe, you find them all substantially in Great Britain. And then there's a huge connection with the U.S. And the reason that's important to me, and I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit,
mm-hmm.
a little overview,
right.
What was so fascinating to me was I studied these years ago, but I didn't have the wherewithal to check the Torah and find out whether somebody was BSing me or whether, you know, now I'm much more prepared for this type of study. But what was so interesting, I was thinking to myself, well, why does he hate America? I mean, you know how many shows I've
talked
along with you. Well, we've talked about that. And
well, when he devotes an entire chapter, well, you know,
yes.
The Great Isaiah Scroll is not broken into chapters,
no,
but we a huge section of it, which is the 18th chapter now of Yashaya Isaiah, and the entire chapter is devoted to condemning the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That ought to get your attention, because the timing of that condemnation is now.
Yes. And if that plus the British Empire plus the European, Western Europe, if any of that revelation stuff is true, he's talking about Western European democracies as well. I mean, there's a connection if you want it. I don't need it for any proof of anything, but, you know, and then the question becomes, well, why do these people hate him so much?
Mm-hmm.
Why does America want to have Israel cut off part of the land or squeeze them in the middle?
I mean, you look at the Obama administration with the Secretary of State went out of his way to rally Europe to a position where he told Israel, you either give up the West Bank and capitulate to the mythical people known as the Palestinians, or we'll make you the pariah of the world, and the entire world is going to boycott you. I mean, Kerry's position that became widely known was blackmail, all in direct opposition to Israel, and in a wholesale compliance with what Yahweh said, that America was going to force Israel to be thinned at the waist and to become undefensible or indefensible.
That was amazing. I also drew another line, and it may take us a while, maybe a couple of shows, before we can get all this information out, so I can prove what I'm saying without and everybody can jump in. But ask yourself this question, because we both came from Christian frames, and we both heard that Paul was getting the gospel out and heading across, and he went across all these places, and he preached in the synagogues and so forth across, and on all the way to Rome.
And by the way, from means we are no longer Christians.
Mm-hmm.
We are extraordinarily opposed to Paul and Christianity.
Yes. The message of why, you know, what Paul
Christianity is the Babylon that we have walked
Christian
away from.
Paul, that's kind of
right. Yes, but Paul had a tremendous anti-Semitic influence.
Yes, he did.
On much of Europe. Because his entire message was focused on Rome and Roman Greece. I mean, and so Europe was the focus, and the power and influence in Europe was the entire focus of his message.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a question. In light of what it's taught that he did and why he did it, let me ask you a question. If he was going to save the Gentile, as he claimed, the Goyim, why didn't he turn right and go to Asia, where the hundreds of millions of people were, India?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why did he turn for this little old group and work his way towards Western Europe?
Because he was all about Rome.
That's right.
He chose a Roman name.
Not only about Rome.
Imperial Rome was the you know, Yahweh made it very clear that, and Rome was the ultimate beast, and what grew out of Rome, the Roman Catholic Church, would tread upon the whole world. He was the troubadour of everything that God has set up that he detested about Rome and the Roman Catholic Church. He was a Roman, man. His manifesto is called Romans, after all.
No, I hear it, but let me ask you another question.
Yeah.
That's true, yes. And in addition to that, who is the better catch for him to find to turn into those Roman Catholics than the House of Israel?
Mm. So he's what you're saying is that the reason he is so
anywhere. Yeah, right, he goes and plays chess.
Yeah. Now this is interesting. Okay,
and know where he went.
Okay. Let me back up here.
Evidence to show he even went further than it is in the book of Acts.
What you're inferring here is actually is an undercurrent of all of his letters.
Yeah.
What you're inferring is that Paul actually tried to convince Israelites in Turkey and in Syria and in the Mediterranean and in Rome and in Greece. He targeted Israelites, Jews, to use the modern term. He targeted them. He really wanted to convince them that he was the had the right answer. And the undercurrent of his letters is that all of them, every single one of them, rejected him. Mm-hmm. And they all rejected him because the claim, the rationale that he was using, they recognized was invalid, that he was misquoting the Torah and the prophets, but primarily misquoting the Torah, and his statements regarding the annulment of the Torah were irrational.
Right.
And so they knew the truth, and therefore they were in a position to say, no, you're lying here. You're not only just lying, you're irrational. And so they universally rejected him, which caused him to condemn them as Judaizers, something, a group, a tendency that has never existed in human history. And so he turned against them because they were smart enough to reject him. The Greeks and the Romans didn't know any better.
No.
And so wholly ignorant of the book he said was invalid, they were in a position where, well, they didn't know enough to be rational. And they didn't know enough to know that he was irrational. But it is a huge undercurrent of his letters.
Well, he found a happy home in all the Western tribes and all the Western Europe, where Christianity eventually took on like fire, wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
And also in England and also obviously in the United States.
Yeah, but part of that, too, was that his message was Jews are horrible people.
Yeah.
Jews are anti-God. Jews are anti-Christ. I mean, that's the theme of his letters. The Jews are anti-Paul, and therefore Rome, which hated Jews, and so did Greece, his message prevailed there. Because the people, the populace of those countries, despised Jews.
And he took that same message to all of Europe, and they all despised them, too. They're all taught that.
Correct.
So it's like, so when you're looking for it, you're saying, well, what is wrong with these people? That they even if we didn't know who a lot of their relations were, who they were to begin with, and so forth, you know, why did they fall in love with? Well, the same reason that Ephraim and Manasseh, those tribes in northern Israel, fell in love with Babylonian ideas.
Yeah, I don't think, though, that there's evidence that the Israelites that were hauled off into captivity in Turkey, Syria, Greece, Rome, and Spain, and then throughout northern Europe as well. I don't think there's significant evidence that they ever capitulated to Paul's message.
Oh no, not in the early, but the eventual when he planted all his seeds, they eventually the Celtics and the Saxons, which you can trace back to the Celtoids crossing over, and that's what the Greeks called them initially. That's where the name even came from. These people, Christianity found a happy home in them. It took them several hundred years before Western Europe became Christianized. And then they were in his pocket. I mean, and those seem to be the people who wanted to, you know, destroy Israel to begin with now today.
Yes.
So.
But he was never able to convince people who knew better. The Jews were literate. They knew what the Torah said, and they knew that his arguments against the Torah were irrational. I mean, that's the basis of questioning Paul it proves that without any question whatsoever. And so they rejected him. Paul made them his enemy, And that resonated with the peoples of these countries eventually, and they continued to hold Jews as their enemies.
Yeah. So to them, it's just doing business.
Right.
You know, I started off with a kind of marching papers. And what I started with was, let me grab it here.
Yeah, by the way, where you're looking for that, Paul then really is the inspiration for replacement theology. Because what Paul says is that the Torah has been replaced by his gospel. And that the chosen people, the Jews, have been replaced by the Gentiles. And so Paul really is the instigator of this myth of replacement theology, that the Christian church, Pauline Christianity, has replaced Yisrael and the Torah.
Yeah. You know, what I started with was Yeshayahu 51:1.
Mm-hmm.
And let me read it to you. And okay. I've done some little translation here, and you can... But it started out with 51:1, Yeshayahu, Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
It says, "Listen to me, you who pursue or took up the pursuit of righteousness, uprightness, reconciliation, who seek to find Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Look, behold, consider, pay attention, have respect for the house of the rock, or the rock, the cliff, the stones, the place of refuge, from which you were hewn, which you were broken apart, and to the quarry, or the place where it is inscribed, and explained, from which you were thrown out." And it says, I think the English translated, dug, but you can also say picked out, thrown out, gouged out. 51:2, very quickly, look to Abraham, it says. This is your advice. This is your marching paper. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who gave birth to you in pain, the travails of childbirth, when he was the only one. It says the one in the Christian Bible, but he was the only one. He was alone. And I called him, and then I blessed him, and then I multiplied him. So if you're looking to see why, this is, you know, so I took that to mean, okay, Yahweh said, go look. If you're going to look and try to figure this out, because we're really talking about end times. It's irrelevant. Some of this stuff
yes.
is it's just fun history.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to begin here is a quick review. Rather than listening to Paul, Yahweh says, listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
This is Yahweh speaking in first person. He says, listen to me, those of you who strive to be correct. That's what tzedak means, to be correct, to be right. Those of you, listen to me, Yahweh, not somebody else. Those of you who strive to be correct, to be right. Those of you who seek Yahweh, not those who seek Jesus or Allah or fame and fortune. Those who seek Yahweh. Look to the rock from which you were hewn. Well, what is the rock? Is it the limestone rock that creates that edifice known as Zion, that is Mount Moriah? Is it the rock out of Yosha, who is the rock of our salvation, who is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh? Is the rock the land of Yisrael? Is the rock the foundation of this whole story, which is the Torah?
Mm-hmm. I think all of the above.
Yeah. Which you were hewn. And to the quarry from which you were dug. For the quarry from which they were dug is Yisrael. And only Yisrael. And then he makes it so clear. Look to Abraham, your father.
There's your way to go looking.
Right. And now, how could Abraham be their father if... the dope whose conspiracy we've been negating for these last 2 weeks is correct in saying that, well, none of the Jews today are related to Abraham. They're all from Eastern Turkey. How could this be true if Yahweh in Yeshayahu 51, talking about a prophetic event of a time not even yet here upon us, still a decade away, he says, look to Abraham, your father. That proves that, from Yah's perspective, there are many Yehudim, Israelites, who are still blood descendants of Abraham and Sarah. That statement alone completely negates the entire argument that was being made by the numbskull. and to Sarah, who gave you birth in travail under, you know, the pain of personal childbirth. You know, it's so interesting because what was the, back in the garden, Kirk, you know, when Yahweh was saying, here's the consequence for your bad decisions. You know, Abraham, you're going to, Adam, you're going to have to work. You know, that's, I think, work is a positive thing. And women, you're going to give birth to children in travail.
Fails, yeah.
So what he's saying is that birth and travail, that painful birth, is Yisrael. By the way, it's the most wonderful experience in a woman's life, also the most painful. But he is now equating that the birth and pain to Yisrael and specifically to the covenant, because what Abraham and Sarah represent is the covenant. Because when I blessed him, that's the covenant. When I multiplied him, that's the covenant. That's how we are multiplied and enriched by the covenant. So I'll let you go on. So there's a lot right there that is so germane to this discussion and so black and white in terms of Yahweh's position.
Yeah. Yes, it's not just a walk through the old history books to see interest in history. It was, to me, it was only to find out a couple of things. Why the Western Europeans and Americans and English want to destroy Israel. What their motive was. Who the heck are they? So another one I'm going to throw in, because I'd like to set all this up a little bit before we actually get to what all the promises were. So just keep it in the right context. What you're going to find is, first of all, if you went to Hosea in 1:10, it's 1:9. Hosea says, which is same as Yahusha, by the way, same name, isn't it?
Yes, Hosea is salvation. It's based upon the Hebrew word Yasha, which is to save and savior. Correct. And Yosha is Yahweh saves, Yahweh and Yasha. Yashayah, the prophet you've just read from, has the verb before the name. So salvation is from Yahweh, from the verb Yasha. So all three are from the verb Yasha, to save.
So I thought that was pretty cool. Now, most people know this story, but I'm kind of setting up a little bit of context here that will play out.
Mm-hmm.
Hosea says, Yahweh says to Hosea, he says, take a wife.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Gomer.
Mm-hmm.
And then she has a child. Now, she is a prostitute.
Yeah, she's not just a prostitute. She's the worst kind of prostitute. She's not a prostitute in the sense of somebody earning a living because she wants to pursue the oldest profession in the world. She's a religious prostitute.
Yeah.
She's the kind of prostitute. The reason that Yahweh besmirches adultery and prostitution and harlots and whores is because they represent religion. She was a religious priestess.
Well, she has her first son. I'm not quoting it verbatim, but she has her first son, and Yahweh tells her to name him Zisrael, God sows, Zara from Zara, to sow, to scatter seed. And I will, and then her second child is a daughter, and it's La Rokhama, which means to be without compassion and love. And then the third child is another son, is Lo Ami, and that means not my people.
Right.
Interesting names, because he's showing you what Israel has done.
Right.
He's telling you what he considers you to be.
Mm-hmm.
The pain, the story of the pain, is the one that Hosea has in being married to this woman. But he's prophetically telling you this is where these people are, where they're going to be so much, and they're not going to be known as my people anymore. And then in the next verses we have 1:10. Yet the number of sons of Israel will be like the sands of the sea. Now, friends, that's a big number, which can be measured or numbered in a place where it said, "You are not my people, and you are the son, but you are the sons of the living God." Now that's a very odd thing to say until you know.
You are not my people, but you're sons of the living God.
Yeah. So right. They're not going to be known. And we know the history of Israel when they split into two post-Solomon, Shalomon, mm-hmm. Where these people are no longer, they've adapted everything pagan. Mm-hmm. From Egyptian sources as well as the old Babylonian stuff and all the people around them, they have turned. They have done the very thing. They have become religious whores themselves.
Yes. Yep.
And God can't take it, you know. And eventually He said, "Okay, you're going to." Eventually, we know He's going. They're going to be taken off by the Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
But here is God.
Yeah, he said, "I'm divorcing you because you've breached the terms and conditions of my covenant." By becoming religious and political and all that sort of thing.
All the things they walk away from,
right.
You've walked right to and beg for more.
Yeah, but He still calls them the sons of the living God, even says, you're not my children.
So, listen,
right.
There was a time out of 70 years for Judah.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to find out there was a time out for these people. And Leviticus of Korah 26, I did that verse, which is a lot. It's about 49 verses. I did that twice.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are four times in there that Yahweh mentions, and He's talking directly to the house of Israel, I'm going to give you a seven-time curse.
Mm-hmm.
Use a prophetic year, and you multiply that out, what you wind up is 2,520 year curse.
Oh, my goodness. And that's the time that the Northern Kingdom...
You've done that before, haven't you?
Oh, no, that's 500.
Okay, well, let me
oh, that's just amazing. Oh, wow.
He says, you're not going to be known. You're not going to be known as my people, which we just told. He just told that story. They're going to be without compassion and love.
And by the way, how many people know that how many people actually call Jews by their correct name?
Almost no.
Yahudim.
Confused. They don't know what tribe is which.
Right. See, they're not known.
Every one of the tribes is Israel.
Right. They're not known
everyone
by their correct name.
Jewish.
Right. They're not known by Yahweh's name.
Brothers, but
right.
They're not in cousins and so forth. But you
okay.
Identify them all as one group, which is Israel.
Right.
But they've been split into two now, and Yahweh is returning for both of them to be clear.
Yeah. They're not even known as Israel. They're not even known as Israel. And
if they're known
as Israel, that means those who engage and endure with God. And Yahuda.
They're not doing that.
Right. Meaning
identification mark.
Those who are related to Yah. Yeah. So they're not known as His people. That is correct.
So
they're known
as
Jews.
If you took when they were thrown out around 721 by the Assyrians,
mm-hmm.
no longer known as my people, and they move away, and then the Persians conquer the Assyrians and they sell them. They tell them you can go back there because they didn't want them.
Right.
You want to go back to your homeland? They said no, and they moved up the Caucasus and we kept on going. They went up through Greece and they also went
right.
up the other side of the Caspian or the Black Sea, around that side. And you can trace them through archaeology. These people. And thousands, and they carry all the heraldry, which we can go into in great detail, and it's really fascinating stuff because it matches up with every promise that God says. God knows who they are. He gave them a great big giant timeout, and it doesn't, and they don't, all that archaeology is not even born until about the 1800s,
mm-hmm.
which brings us right to the point of 2,520 years from 721.
Yes.
Now you start to put the little pieces together, and you can find out who these people are if you're looking for what Yahweh said.
Correct.
So it's rather fascinating. So when you I started back. I'm just going to keep doing some verses if you don't mind,
mm-hmm.
And then we'll get into the promises. If Bereshit Genesis 12 1-3, Yahweh told Abraham to go from your country, your father's house, to a land that I'll show you, and I will make you and become a great people. The word that they use translate for people is goem. Which I thought
okay.
was interesting.
Because yeah,
when you really think about it,
the primary Hebrew word.
Because you have
right.
to go quite a few generations, four generations,
right,
four generations
yeah.
his great-grandson before
right,
you have
yeah.
a Yehudim.
Right, the primary word, Hebrew word for people is actually am, which means people who are family. Goy and goyim are used,
mm-hmm.
it means unrelated people.
Mm-hmm. And that's
unrelated.
Funny. Now, a lot of people will tie this together and they say, well, you know, that means of Israel, Ishmael, and maybe the three sons that he had by the, or six sons he had by the other woman after Sarah died. No, they don't count. Ishmael, he told him right away, they're not in the mix. Then Abraham asked him, he said, what about Ishmael? He said, no, absolutely not, zero. That ain't the tracing line. The only tracing line has to come through Sarah's children. The children begat by her, they become the house of Israel. I mean, people can argue with that, but to me it makes no sense at all that you would trace any others to. Any of these blessings are not going to be there. So the blessings we're finding from these people that are more numerous than sand. Now listen, you've got Asians, you've got the Slavic people, you've got Africans, you've got Mongolians, you've got the South American, North American Indians, which are pretty much like the Mongolians. I'm sure they came across on the thing. I'm sure that information is right. You have, and the only other massive group of people you have would be the Celtics.
Yes.
So, I mean, either that or Yah's got some real problems here with these verses, so it doesn't bother me. Listen, Yah still don't like them.
No.
I'm not building a case for how wonderful these people are. I'm just trying to trace them and find out who these people are that that God's talking about. And then he says, and I will make you become a great people, and your name, Shem, will be magnified, and you'll become a blessing. And I will bless those that bless you. And this is the verse where, you know, I'll bless those that bless you, and mm-hmm. I'll curse those who curse you. And in him, all the families of the earth will be blessed. You know,
right. And that is, by the way, the only means to a to receive a blessing from Yahweh. Blessing means for God to kneel down to lift us up. The only way to do it is
we don't know how what the deal is, and the only place you can find the deal is the Torah.
Right, and that is
the thing.
Right,
you know,
yeah. All came.
Give us. There is no reconciliation without this book, and nobody's taking care of it. Who got it? We will find out, as we already know. But we'll find out that you had two promises. One was to be a shepherd king, and the other was to keep the Torah.
Yes.
Not in the sense of keeping laws, but to hold on to it. And who had it?
Right.
Who brought it to the world? Who shepherded us with the knowledge of what Yahweh said? Yodim.
Yes.
Consistently. Everybody else walks away. They didn't. Now, they screwed it up a lot, but be that as it may. So in any case, what we might want to do, there's some other promises that will play out about when he talks about two tribes, and there's a lot of stuff in Korah 26 and Yirmiyah and Yashiyah and so forth. But and this is what as our time is still, we still have a little time. I thought perhaps, if you don't mind, let's look at the promises that are given to the 12 tribes, 13 counting Loi, the Israelites, by first of all in Genesis, and if you're looking for those, you can read along on this Barber Sheath or Genesis 49, and he's going to itemize every tribe in there and all the blessings. Now, it's interesting. I've been working on this all week, trying to dig out each one of these words and so forth, and some of it is very good and some of it is pretty horrible on what he's telling them from the get-go. And then also what you do is you'll go, if you go to Dabarim, which is the words of Moshe, when he talks about some additional things that apply to these, which would be in Dabarim 33. So for our friends who are listening along with us, and that's where you can find all the promises. So about that. But you've got Reuben. And I'm going to do kind of a short form rather than go through all of it, but it is rather exciting.
Yeah, the one here, of course, that is just devastating is 49:27, speaking of the ultimate Benjamite.
The
ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours his prey, in the evening he divides his spoil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, remember the chart we were talking about last week? There was four groups. And I didn't know that to this week. I didn't ever thought that much about it. It was just a nice chart, and it kind of tells them where they lined up, and there's probably more to it, and I didn't know I have enough brains to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go back to that chart a little bit for just a second. And when he lays them out, you've got the there's four groups that he talks about a lot, and it's very obvious about that when you go through the promises. Each group of threes that are in this box that go around the lower or the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
In the north, facing the north, you have Dan. Now, Dan is the dominant player between Asher, along with Asher and Naphtali. He's the dominant player in that group. Mm-hmm. To the east, of course, you have Yehuda, and you have Zebulun and Issachar.
Right.
We talked about them last week. But now to the west, you have the dominant player there is Ephraim and Manasseh, and oddly enough, is Benjamin. Because you always associate Benjamin with Loi and Yehuda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
well, why did he put him there? And then at the bottom, you have Reuben, Shimeon, and Gad at the south facing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, orient yourself a minute. Now, this is just me talking. Just me and you talking and everybody else. You know, if I'm wrong, that's okay. I thought to myself as I'm reading this, you've got Dan's facing north, Yehuda's facing east. Dan, if you look at Europe on where these people went to,
mm-hmm.
you have a huge amount of Yehudim in the eastern part of Europe. No question mm-hmm. about that. Catherine the Great, you know, finally expelled a bunch of them because they were too powerful, because they were the only people that could run the country or run that part of the country because they were literate. And that, and it grew such a large population. It's a Catherine story. She wasn't cruel like the Egyptians were, but she encouraged them to leave. So they mm-hmm. moved across, a lot of the Yehudim moved across that way. If you Dan, and we'll find out what Dan's symbols are, and you're going to find he absolutely dominates the northern part of Europe. The House of Dan, you might say, or maybe we can thank Danmark.
Denmark.
The Dan.
Wow, the mark of Dan.
And look at the
yeah.
symbols, and they're exactly the same ones as the House of Dan.
Yes. Wow.
And then you go to the western part, and we have this horrible, horrible mixture of people going away, going astray, of Ephraim. And then you have Manasseh, and then throw in the mix, you have Benjamin. And every time I look at Benjamin, no offense to old Ben, but all I can see is Paul.
Oh, of course. The ultimate yeah. Benjamite. You acknowledge he was a Benjamite?
Shaul.
Right.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Yahweh.
Number one or Shaul, number two.
Right. Yeah, Yahweh yeah. Yeah. specifically says the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Right.
Yeah, the wolf in sheep's clothing that'll tear you apart.
Yeah.
That's Paul. So we are Benjamin represents Pauline Christianity, and the west of Israel is not only Western Europe but the United States, which is mm-hmm. the home.
Oh yeah, of, those symbols in a freaking
yeah.
I mean, it's and what's interesting now, Reuben doesn't have a real place because he's told he's going to be powerful and he's still going to be strong and everything because he really messes up his life on the things he does. Yahweh still gives him a huge blessing,
mm-hmm.
but he's dispersed among and probably in the southern part of Europe. If you think, if I dug hard enough, I could probably find a larger group in the southern part of Europe than I would anywhere else before you get to the western part, where they all wind up in such yeah. large numbers.
You know, France. Is fairly
Gauls,
yeah, it's fairly Gauls, fairly southern in Europe.
Yes.
Gaul, by the way, and Gad are kind of interesting the tie in there. But and mm-hmm. that's the very high percentage of Jews mm-hmm. in Europe who live in France.
Yeah.
And that's southern Europe.
There's enough evidence there. There's just not a dominant thing like Ephraim and Manasseh. Now Manasseh. If you, what I'll try to prove to you,
mm-hmm.
Ephraim's symbols are so dominant in Great Britain and so in keeping with the promises he gave Ephraim of how they'll push the world around and the sun never sets on the British Empire and da-da-da-da-da-da. It's so plain, at least to me, and,
mm-hmm.
that, and I think I can convince just about anybody that that's who the bulk of them are and who they've adapted. They certainly have all the symbolism. Manasseh. Is so much in our symbols of the United States is freaky, and they do the same things, but they're lesser. They are dominated by that Benjamin because of the religious factor of Christianity.
Right.
I mean, it's just it's a scary thing. Dan's group up in northern Europe. Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and so forth carry all of those symbols with them. They're the only people in the world that do it, by the way. It's not like it's somewhere you're going to go out somewhere and find somewhere and that's not related right. to the British Empire.
Yeah, Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake on the path. Yeah, a serpent on the way, a snake on the path for your salvation. I will wait, says Yahweh. It's interesting, too, by the way, that Gad is depicted there in South Eastern Europe because of that position, because it's out of Greece and Italy in the very southern part and southeastern part of Europe that we find the birth of a religion where the deity was named God.
Gad.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild. So back to the promises.
Mm-hmm.
And on our time, we're probably not going to get through too much today, but we'll at least set the stage if we can. Reuben, let me turn over this. I'm sorry, there's a little bit of noise here.
The firstborn.
Yeah, Reuben is the firstborn. And because he really messes up, his symbols become, because of what he did, he is an all man. He acts poorly. He's tough, though. He's supposedly, he should be handsome. Probably it implies that he's handsome, good looking. He's a dignified man. He tells him that he is all of these things.
But he's uncontrolled as water.
Indiscretions. In fact, his name means behold the sun, because he was the first one. Because of this, he says that, yes, you're a man, and the symbol of you, the primary symbol of him, is going to be a man. But he has a secondary symbol, because it's in the body of water. It's the water marks, or little curvy things, look like little kids draw waves.
Mm-hmm.
He's strong, he's powerful, he's able, he's even calls him exalted and dignified, an authority of high position. However, because of his indiscretions, he says, you're not going to have... you're not going to be head of a big deal. You'll be part of, but you find Reuben in a whole bunch of places where Ephraim is and Manasseh is, some of the symbols as well as those down in the southern part of Europe.
Yeah. I like it. In fact, he calls them uncontrolled water.
Uncontrolled.
Because, water is the most...
Water you can't control.
Right. Uncontrolled water is probably the most destructive force in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the a tidal wave or it's a the surge from a storm or the waves or the erosion of a river, uncontrolled water, if a dam breaks and water's no longer controlled, it's just devastating.
Yeah. And that's the way he was. Well, that was the terrible things that he did. And that's, and you would think he would have cut him out. But then I found a verse at Devarim 21:17. Where he said, even though he is the son of the unloved wife, because he was, he was among the first wife, because he had three.
Mm-hmm.
His father had three. He still is entitled to a double portion. So he's still powerful, he's still around, but he's not allowed to be like Ephraim or Judah, or even Manasseh for that matter.
Yeah, and of course, by being uncontrolled water, water at the sea is the symbol of Gentiles.
Yeah.
So he's going to have no control in the realm of Gentiles.
All right. So if you look up those verses, look up all those words, there's nothing, it's no other conclusion you can come to. So Reuben's symbols, oddly enough, his primary symbol is a man. They took it everywhere they go. It's still there today. Where you find descendants of Reuben, and his secondary is a body of water.
Yeah.
And Reuben's emblems are found in places like the royal arms of Denmark, Greece, Iceland, Lapland, Sweden, the Netherlands, as well as some of the southern parts of Europe.
But yeah, man of the sea, so the seafaring countries, whether it be all of northern Europe was made its living by being seafaring peoples, such was also the case with Great Britain and Spain and France, but northern Europe in particular, along the Baltic Sea, you were either seafaring or you didn't exist, and the man of the sea.
Yeah. So what I did, Craig, was I took the first four. I've got all of them, but I took the first the four big ones on each side of the arrangement where they made camp. And the next one I went to was Judah, Yehuda. And he says, your brothers will praise you. They would give thanks and acknowledge, your hand shall be on the neck of the of your enemies, and your father's son shall respect and revere you. Yehuda is a young lion. This is 49:9, 8, and 9. Yehuda is a young lion from the prey.
My son, you have gone.
My son, I'm sorry. You have gone. He couches. He lies down as a lion, and he dares to. And who dares to rouse him up?
Right. So it's a lion. It's a lion that's not standing up.
No, he's kind of sitting up. You know, like they would in the wilderness. If you went out to Africa and you saw those lions there, they mm-hmm. they'll have your attention. They won't necessarily get up because they're not ready to charge.
Right. Yeah, this is not a lion standing on all four. This is
the whole thing, and they're crouched or they're sitting. With
right.
the sitting up position.
Right.
So that's where we're going to get the symbol of that, and we'll find out that that's exactly what they used, both back in ancient Israel and with us today.
Mm-hmm.
In 49:10, you have the scepter. That's the scepter. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, from Yehuda, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, and to him shall be... Oh, I'm missing something.
Yeah. Well, the scepter shall not depart from Yehuda. That's forever, by the way.
Yeah.
Nor shall the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And to him shall be listening, because obedience, there is no word for obedience in Hebrew.
Right,
the people shall listen. Yeah, it's Shema. People shall listen. And by the way, until Shiloh comes, this is Yom Kippurim. They're not talking about, you know, Christians will say, well, you know, it passed from Yehuda when their Jesus came. Well, no, Jesus is not Shiloh.
No.
No, this is speaking of the fulfillment of Yom Kippurim.
And so, you know, once again, in 33:7, which we have Dabarim,
mm-hmm.
hear Yahweh, the voice of Yehuda, and bring him unto his people, and let his hand be sufficient and contended for them and counted for them, and may you, speaking of Yah, be a help against them, all of his adversaries. Usually, what I was finding that when Dabarim is talked, the first one is telling you a history that's end time, their history plus the end time, very heavy emphasis on that.
Mm-hmm.
And in Dabarim, when Moshe is to him, they're in pretty good shape. He's wiped out all the early group. And these are the sons that were under 25 that grew up, and now they're more into the promised land. So it must be something, because they were so kind on what he would say to each one of these people for the most part when they entered the promised land. They started a fresh slate.
Right.
It's the only way I can reconcile that in my brain, because it wasn't historic as much or prophetic as much as it was.
Those who were in religious defiance
were
gone.
Saying, let's go out on a good note. We're together. Let's be family. And this is what I'm wishing for you. I'm hoping for you. I'm blessing you to be prosperous and fruitful and happy and so forth. But in 49, he's telling you you can trace everything on what they're going to do. So then you go over and you look at Judah, and his primary symbol is a lion. Now it comes in three. There's a couple of secondary emblems that they use. One is three lions laying down, and the other is the scepter and a grapevine.
Mm-hmm.
You will find that all over Great Britain.
Yeah.
And the house of whoever the reigning king or queen happens to be at the time and right now.
The Tudors, currently.
And the Tudors, yeah. Oh, no, the Windsors.
Windsors, I'm sorry, yeah, the Windsors.
It was right before them. They stole it from them.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have Dan. Funny, Terry started looking up all those English... kings and queens, the current thing and how they run the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that woman has, which I didn't realize as much. I knew that when I grew up in Australia, we had to get up every morning and say, God save the Queen. And even though we were a Commonwealth, not part of the empire per se, we still had to get up at school every morning and we had to sing God save the Queen. And
God didn't even know the queen.
No, God don't know the queen, and well, some God, but it ain't Yahweh. But she's still the queen. She's still the queen of Canada. She's still the queen of all the Commonwealth. They have
passed. We'll pick this up next week.
And really doing a lot of research on that. It was quite fascinating. They, man, she could shut a lot of things down. She is not just a titular head sitting up there for ceremony purposes. She's powerful.